Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents How to Marry a Marble Marquis, a Regency Monster Romance, by C.M. Nascosta. Narrated by Justine Eyre and Rupert Channing. The High Tea. Society Papers. Dearest readers, welcome to the High Tea, where the Ton's every misstep is served up with a piping fresh pot of scandal. In this book you will find plucky heroines, unrepentant rakes who act like rakes. That means relationships outside of his with our FMC, dear readers. Discussions of poverty and peerage, knotting and sleep play, mentions of self-harm of the stone variety, and more saucy banter than we can hold in a pot. This is a standalone Regency monster romance that takes place within the shared world of the Monster's Ball. But it is also the beginning of the much-anticipated Talons and Temptations series from your author. Please see her back matter to learn more on what's coming next. Until next time, sip slowly, my dears. Lady Grey. The High Tea. Society Papers. Sweet sippers, do we have a scandal for you? Some attendees of Lady Harthington's resplendent snowdrop ball received an eyeful of more than they'd likely expected to see this past week. Cuckolded by his own valet in plain sight of the manor. A parvenu scandal with a capital P. Our loyal little serving spoons tell us the lady of disrepute was one Miss E., and we have no doubt the wick she had left on the embers of his lordship's generosity has been thoroughly extinguished. This tea trollop has surely seen the end on her season, for no respectable lady would act in such a way. Good riddance, we say. Sip slowly, my dears. Lady Grey. Eleanor. Dear Miss Eastwick, on account of the unfortunate incident involving Lord Pemberley and his valet at Lady Harthington's ball, Her Majesty has no choice but to deem your season a failure. With no other suitors of an appropriate station and no dowry, you are hereby ordered to attend the Monster's Ball, your last hope of securing a marriage for the season. The parchment crumpled in her fist as her hand closed. The letter from the Queen was the ultimate humiliation. So kind of Her Majesty to ensure you'll never forget how utterly inept and unmarriageable you are. Eleanor wasn't sure why she kept punishing herself by reading it over and over again. Perhaps as a way to remind herself of the precariousness of her position and how important this last card to play was, she reminded herself, placing the letter in an empty drawer, tucked out of sight, wishing she could hide away her humiliation as easily. The High Tea had recounted the entire mortifying incident to all of London society, making her and Lord Pemberley both laughing stocks. Some attendees of Lady Harthington's resplendent snowdrop ball received an eyeful of more than they'd likely expected to see this past week. Cuckolded by his own valet in plain sight of the manor, a parvenu scandal with a capital P. Our loyal little serving spoons tell us the lady of disrepute was one Miss E., and we have no doubt the wick she had left on the embers of his lordship's generosity has been thoroughly extinguished. Good riddance, we say. Her face heated further at the thought. The High Tea was a scourge of London, a gossip publication devoted to the Ton's marriage market. They had eyes at every ball, every garden soiree, every riding excursion and game of croquet. Perhaps he hadn't seen it. After all, lords of high standing had no use for trivial gossip. This Marquis of Basingstoke likely wouldn't either. I'm sure he has more important things to worry about than some silly, inaccurate slander. The incident with Lord Pemberley's valet was not her fault. The man was rude and quite insistent in his failed manners, and she hadn't required his assistance in the first place. If he was going to offer his hand to help her descend the carriage steps, the least he could have done was to ensure the pathway was cleared of loose stones and frolicking spaniels. That Lord Pemberley had turned just in time to see her sprawled out over his manservant, her knees coming down on either side of his legs as if she were mounting a horse, clawing at his waistcoat to regain her balance, the man's big hand attempting to steady her, and instead cupping a generous handful of her posterior, was all simply a dreadful misunderstanding. She should have cut her losses then, but like the foolish optimist she was, she had continued into the ball, hoping against hope that the incident outside would remain in the dust. Her faith in her fellow revellers was misplaced. Lady Harthington eyed her as if she were a particularly unattractive bug every time Eleanor happened to find herself in the crosshairs of the woman's gaze, and Lord Pemberley seemed intent on forgetting she existed. She wound up spending most of the evening sitting at a cluster of tables with the other wallflowers, wishing she had simply stayed in Paris. A failure, a failure, a failure. Heat rose to her cheeks every time she read the blasted missive, and Eleanor knew that moment was no exception. "Pull yourself together. He's going to be here any moment. You don't need to look like a strawberry when he does." Resting her forehead against the cool marble on the side of the fireplace, she sucked in a centering breath, counting to three before turning, casting her gaze over the room once more. Everything was perfect, or at least as perfect as they could make it under the circumstances. The table was set for tea. The sterling tea service belonged to her grandmother, a wedding gift, and Eleanor had repolished it that morning herself, ensuring that she could see her face in the surface of the pot and sugar bowl and in each dainty spoon. Fresh flowers were set in a cut crystal vase in the centre of the table, and the firelight winked off the leaded glass. If the sun was shining, it would have cast her prison of rainbows on the far wall beyond the base, but as it was the middle of the night, the effect was only aided by the lamps and candles around the room. Eleanor went around fluffing chintz pillows and straightening the curtains, ensuring the side window that overlooked the garden was framed in a way that gave the room an ethereal, moonlit glow. Lucy had been practicing her tea-making skills for nearly 2 weeks in preparation for that night. She'd finally achieved the mastery of steeping the tea just long enough to achieve a rich golden hue from the tightly rolled leaves, removing the kettle from the heat and decanting the leafless tea into the sterling pot before it turned bitter. She and Coraline had painstakingly prepared the dainty savouries, turning each tiny square of quiche and smoked ham into a culinary delicacy fit for the Queen herself. Hopefully fit enough for the Marquis of Basingstoke. His lordship didn't need to know that his meal had been prepared by children, for she certainly didn't anticipate that he would ask to speak with the cook. The tea service would fetch a fine price at auction if it came to that. The tea set and the needlepoint chairs, the fine crystal and all of the porcelain. The grandfather clock in the front hall had a face inlaid with mother-of-pearl, and Eleanor was certain that too would do handsomely if it was sold to the right bidder. She had already sold off most of Mother's jewellery, saving one special piece for each of the girls. Father's silver-topped walking stick had gone the way of the baubles and gems, along with the pianoforte that had been her entire childhood. Soon the house would be an empty shell as she sold off their belongings one by one. Like a cavernous dollhouse devoid of furniture or dolls or any carefree little girl to play with it, all of their memories and fine things scattered to the wind like ashes. "Stop it. He's going to be here any moment. You need to remember yourself, remember your manners. Show him that you are, in fact, a lady of good standing. Uncle Ephraim wouldn't have suggested this if the monster's ball wasn't your last hope." Drawing in another deep breath, Eleanor moved back to the fireplace, posing herself in a way that she hoped was alluring, and readied herself. She was already able to hear the clip-clop of horse hooves and knew that would likely be his carriage. This is it. She was going to be taking courting advice from some dreadful old man, possibly one with a wandering hand, but if he had a nephew or a cousin of marrying age, it would all be worth it in the end. "You're doing this for the girl." Her head felt heavy as he was announced, her grandmother's nurse doing a valiant job at playing house servant for the night. Hetty was attempting to disguise her country accent with what she probably thought was meant to be posh, but wound up sounding as if she'd only learned the common tongue that same day. The Marquis of Basingstoke has come to call, miss. Hetty stepped aside, the gargoyle behind her moving forward, his nose in the air, and Eleanor froze. She didn't know why she had been picturing someone of an age with Uncle Ephraim. Perhaps it was the stuffiness of his title, or the fact that he knew Uncle Ephraim at all. She had envisioned a gentleman even older than the Earl, white of hair and wrinkled of face, perhaps with a cane. She had been berating herself for this mad plan all week, not understanding the Earl's suggestion, nor why taking advice from some old man would do her any good in finding a husband. But now she understood perfectly. The Marquis of Basingstoke was far younger than she had anticipated, perhaps a decade older than herself at most. He did have white hair, she sniffed. A shock of silver-white hair tumbling appealingly over a sharply arched brow of the same snowy colour. Twisting horns sprouted from his head, pushing through his white hair like the twinned spires of mountains above a lush valley of snow. His skin was black as pitch, veined in the same luminous white of his hair, almost glowing across cheekbones so sharp she wondered if he'd ever accidentally cut himself. He was devilishly handsome, and to add insult to injury, his figure was as appealing as his face. The intricate jacquard on his waistcoat stretched across a broad, well-muscled chest that tapered to a waspish waist, and the cherry-sized sapphire pinned at the centre of his cravat was the same shade of blue as his narrowed eyes. His trousers looked practically painted on, disappearing into high Hessian boots, the shine upon which rivalled her tea-setting. Eleanor consoled herself that while she was gaping at him as if she'd never seen a member of the opposite sex before, he was taking her in just as thoroughly. She felt the drag of those keen blue eyes up her form and wondered if he could tell that her dress was twice turned already. As he took a step further into the room, his wide wings blotted out the sight of the housekeeper altogether, and his tight-lipped smile curved, arriving at her eyes at last. "Lord Stride," she finally squeaked out, remembering herself. "I'm so grateful you were able to come this evening. Thank you, Hetty. That will be all for now, but you can begin preparing our tea."
"Miss Eastwick,"
the gargoyle before her purred, taking her proffered hand as soon as the door had clicked shut behind them.
"Thank you for your most gracious invitation."
If Hetty had wished to sound posh for the evening, conversing several minutes with Lord Silas Stride would have served as an ample lesson in the elocution of the nobility. His voice was silky, practically a drawl, managing to sound lofty and bored out of his mind simultaneously. He enunciated every crisp consonant and hung on each voluptuous vowel, his voice icy and white, like a slide of satin, as striking as his appearance.
"I admit," he sniffed,
his gloved hand releasing hers at last,
"to being quite intrigued by the correspondence I received from the Earl of Eckwelling.
I'm so grateful to him for writing to you. Please, let's sit." Eleanor held her breath as the Marquis came around the table, pulling her chair out with a little bow. He was cordial enough, but he was so unlike what she was expecting. A doddering old man with a wild shock of hair coming from his ears, perhaps, that she felt completely unprepared for the rest of the night. All of her careful preparations and rehearsed speeches had been designed for someone old enough to be her grandfather, who might look at her with the kindly eyes of the village vicar, or else some lecherous old uncle who would gape at her décolleté, make ribald jokes, and each facet of her plan seemed woefully ill-prepared now. When he was last seated across from her, she finally dared to blink. "It's a very fair evening," she chirped, hoping she sounded serene and unflappable, and not at all like someone who was content to roll around with a footman in plain sight of the household. "I'm quite relieved the weather has remained so mild. This time of year can sometimes be so unpredictable." He eyed her with an inscrutable look for an endless heartbeat before a lopsided smile split his features, giving her a glint of gleaming white fang.
"It is indeed a fair evening. You chose a fortuitous night for our little liaison.
Yes, she laughed nervously. I confess, my lord, I'm not actually certain how far it was you had to travel. Lord Ellingbow did not mention how far your residence is. I do hope it wasn't too arduous a journey. The penetrating look had not yet eased up, and Eleanor squirmed under the weight of his cool blue eyes. It seemed to her as if he were waiting for her to make some horrid blunder, and she wondered if the story of Lady Harthington's ball had already reached his long, pointed ears. She could already hear the tea cart making its way down the hall, and could imagine Lucy and Coraline both skipping along beside it, ensuring their miniature culinary masterpieces were perfectly placed.
"Not at all, Miss Eastwick. I was already in London, as it were. I'll be returning to Basingstoke this week to settle some affairs, and then relocating to London for the next few months. Londonderry is so dreadfully dull this time of year. I'll be glad for the change of scenery."
She gave him her most charming smile. "I'm sure your duties keep you busy, my lord. Although that coastal scenery is likely quite restorative for one's health, even if the town is dreadfully dull." Another tight-lipped grin, his eyes still searching.
"As restorative as rain-soaked cliffs have the power of being, I suppose. And how is it that you are acquainted with the Earl, Miss Eastwick?"
"Oh, of course. Well, you see, Lord Ellingbow was a friend of my father. They became acquainted when my father was staying up in the northern country before he'd even met my mother. They were both fond of..."
"I'm more curious," he interrupted,
one of his white brows arching sardonically,
"as to why exactly the Earl of Ecwellynt is so interested in the marriage prospects of a woman who is neither his daughter nor his mistress, nor even his ward. I would expect such consternation over a daughter with three seasons behind her, even coming from a concerned aunt or grandmother. It seems unusual for the same concern to originate from a wholly uninvested party, you see."
Eleanor felt each word like a blow, each more humiliating than the last. He must have interpreted her stricken look correctly, for he shrugged gracefully, shaking his hair from his brow with a toss of his head. A shrug was hardly conciliatory, she thought furiously, for he'd essentially called her a spinster with no prospects, and a suspicious one at that.
"Come now, Miss Eastwick. We've discussed the weather and the restorative properties of the northern cliffs. As enchanting as your company might be, I'm certain exchanging the most banal of pleasantries is not why I was written to join you for tea."
The tea cart had arrived, saving her from her shock over his shocking and frankly inexcusable rudeness. Eleanor had known men like him, lords like him, and they were all the same, utter prats. She would have been happy to cut the Marquis's visit short, but from her position facing the door, she was able to see the two small heads attempting to peer invisibly around the jamb as Hetty pushed the rattling cart into the room, reminding her that she wasn't doing this for herself. The conversation paused as the aged nurse carefully placed the three-tiered tray on the centre of the table, along with the gleaming silver pot. Eleanor watched the Marquis of Basingstoke take advantage of the distraction to cast his sharp blue gaze around the room. She wondered what he saw, if he could tell where the piano had once stood, or if he could see the slight discoloration of the wood on the shelves that had once been full of books. When Hetty took her leave once more, he turned to face her again, resuming the conversation as if there had been no interruption at all.
"The letter I received from the Earl was woefully thin on what, specifically, was being requested of me. I crave your indulgence, Miss Eastwick. I've always been dreadful at waiting for things. Patience is, regrettably, one of the many virtues I lack."
Eleanor folded her hands in her lap primly. She was in danger of biting her tongue hard enough to draw blood, as she pressed her lips together tightly in a smile, wondering if he could see the daggers in her eyes. What a rude man. They're all the same, these lords, only good for one thing, the security they can provide. If only Lord Ellingbow was still in London, her situation might not be as dire. Alas, the Earl had retired to his manor house, his eldest son and heir moving into the London residence and assuming the duties of the title. She'd only met the stony son of the Orc Lord once, but it had been enough for her to understand he'd not be as willing to take on a charity case as his father. Uncle Ephraim had done enough by writing to this Marquis. And now you can't go squandering the opportunity. You can't afford to. Think of the girls. This gargoyle was the same sort of fop who would crowd around the backstage area at the theatre, attempting to press roses into her arms and take her to dinner, a surefire way, they always thought, of getting under her skirts. She had never needed any of them then, and she'd never given in to their artificial charms. And we won't be giving in to this one either, but we do need his connections. She cleared her throat, wondering if there was any sense in trying to dance around the truth. Not likely. Just get on with it. Uncle Ephraim was a good friend of my late father, she began again, a thread of ice accompanying her words. My parents are gone. A carriage accident. I was staying abroad at the time, but after the accident I returned to London to be a guardian to my younger sisters. You're quite right, Lord Stride. I am hardly of an age to be entering society for the first time. I would prefer to focus on securing a future match for my sister, but...
But you need to marry yourself to have the ability to do so, he interrupted again, reaching the conclusion of her story before she could do so herself.
We don't have any close family, she went on through gritted teeth. Lord Ellingbow heard about my recent misfortunes and...
Ah, yes, the parvenu scandal with a capital P.
Eleanor wondered if she would ever be able to complete a sentence while in the Marquis of Basingstoke's haughty company. He chuckled, and that too was an icy white sound.
It's as if they don't even make an attempt to be clever sometimes. As someone whose exploits have been regularly and thoroughly excoriated by the High Tea, if it is any consolation, my dear Miss Eastwick, you can rest assured that by the next edition, no one remembers anything from the previous week. There's always a new target.
She was going to need to have the inside of her lip sewn up once this evening was through, Eleanor thought, as she practically chewed a hole into it, a desperate effort to keep her occasionally barbed tongue from finding its target in the gargoyle across from her.
You do have my deepest sympathies for your loss, he went on, his voice losing a fraction of its chill. I, too, have experienced the unfortunate role of being orphaned in adulthood, with younger siblings to think of. I take it that Lord Ellingbow was the one to sponsor your season, then, he continued. Although I am a bit surprised that he went to such lengths on your behalf, rather than simply finding a match for you himself here in London. I suppose that owes to the fact that the Earl has vacated London completely. A premature decision, in my opinion, but that's Northerners for you.
She exhaled slowly through her nose, determined to keep her voice light. Begging your pardon, Lord Stride, but is Londonderry not in the north? I hadn't realised those rain-soaked cliffs had been relocated. His mouth split, another flash of white fang, although his smile reached his eyes this time, sparkling across the table, as blue and shining as the sapphire he wore, and her breath caught in spite of herself.
So it is, Miss Eastwick, so it is. Now, just to ensure I'm keeping the details straight, Lord Ellingbow sponsored your season, a season that I'm assuming is now over, thanks to Lord Pemberley's valet, more's the pity, my dear.
Not over quite yet, my lord, she bit out, ignoring his jab. I shall be attending the Monster's Ball. Uncle Ephraim sponsored my season for the same reason he wrote to you on my behalf. She hesitated, watching his eyebrow raise in expectation. She felt as if she was standing in the centre of the stage, a limelight casting her in a halo, holding her breath before the music began. That was always the most fraught moment, the most vulnerable. Just her, alone, standing before a sea of onlookers she couldn't make out. She was just as alone now. Heat crept up her neck, and Eleanor had the terrible feeling she was near tears.
Her eyes fought away from his, disliking their cold appraisal. But all around her were the reminders of why this meeting was so important. The empty shelves where a library of books had once stood. Books she'd sold one by one. The missing furniture. Her sisters would wind up as seamstresses and governesses, never enjoying a home of their own at this rate. You don't have a choice. I don't know what I'm doing, Lord Stride. Obviously, I have proven to be... She sighed forcefully. A bit of a hopeless case. Lord Ellingbow thought you would be admirably positioned to instruct me to increase my chances of success.
Instruct you?
On how to win a husband at the Monsters' Ball. I've not had fair fortune with men of my own species, let alone navigating the social waters within a community in which I am completely inexperienced. I am not able to pay you to do so, but I'm committed to making up for the use of your time in any way you deem necessary. I'm hoping you will be amenable to the request, but I understand, my lord, if you find it too peculiar. Silence stretched between them, the Marquis still appraising at her, as if he were waiting for her to burst into flames. Eleanor felt her heart sink like a stone within her. This was all a waste of time. You may as well pack up the girls now and try to find employment in some lord's country house. If you're lucky, you can all stay together.
Travelling abroad, you mentioned. Most unusual. Do you often take tea in the middle of the night, Miss Eastwick?
His question was unexpected, and his tone overly casual. Eleanor floundered. She was grateful for the break in the topic, for it allowed her to suck in a breath and push back the tears that had been hovering just beneath the surface of her composure. But the question itself left her feeling unmoored.
I beg your pardon, my lord?
He gestured to the full afternoon tea service before them before lifting his cup, taking a long swallow before resuming.
Do you often enjoy afternoon tea at nearly 2 a.m, Miss Eastwick?
Eleanor snapped her mouth shut after a moment, realizing she had opened it in shock at the audacity of such a question.
Of course not, and he bloody well knows it.
I don't, my lord, no. Although I am often up at this hour. Sleep does not find me easily these days, and I've always been a bit of a night owl. I've never entertained company of the nocturnal persuasion, and I only sought to make your visit more comfortable, Lord Stride. My sincerest apologies if we failed in our attempt.
The Marquis of Basingstoke grinned, chuckling to himself.
Perhaps he'll hurry up and leave once he says no. The less you have to look upon his smug smirk, the better, and you'll never need to see him again.
You intimate that you lack social graces and you've no experience with the monstrous gentry, and yet, he drawled, draining his cup, you took into account the time of our little tete-a-tete, understood that this would be what you would consider the middle of the afternoon for me, and you made accommodations to the best of your ability. You are a charming hostess, a genial conversationalist, I'm assuming, when you don't have such a rude partner, of course, and lovely to behold, if not a bit conservative. I don't find you hopeless at all, Miss Eastwick. I accept your offer. I should be glad to help you secure a husband at the Monsters' Ball. As a matter of fact, I can guarantee it. The joy of your company will be payment enough, of that I have little doubt. My only request is that you do exactly as I say, and don't second-guess my methodology. By the time I'm through with you, you will have your choice of suitors.
He left shortly thereafter, and by the time his carriage disappeared into the dark road, Eleanor was slumped against the door. The tiered tray of sweets and savouries had barely been touched, but it was expensive meat and cheese, too fine to go to waste, and the girls would enjoy the tiny delicacies the following day. He was going to help her, she reminded herself, finally trudging to bed, only an hour or two before dawn. He was going to help her, and things were going to work out. It didn't matter that she would be marrying a stranger, both in personality and form, nor did it matter that the Marquis of Basingstoke and his sharp gaze left her discomforted. She was simply going to have to get used to it. "You're going to be spending a lot of time in his company over the next few weeks,"
What was that he said? He would be in London indefinitely for the next several months. Plenty of time to flourish under his tutelage.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?